Thanks to so many of you for being here. I know it's pterodactyl hunt night. It's probably a hard choice for you. I was thinking earlier on, it's my first time ever having to compete with a pterodactyl hunt. The only thing I can think of that's sort of like that is one time I was at the Toronto Book Fair years ago, and it's kind of like the Target of literary festivals. It's like a gigantic room, and there's all these publishers, and they're giving away free stuff and trying to get people to come and pay attention to their authors, and then they sort of make you go up. It was like a boxing ring, I think, that they had set up, and it was very weird, strange thing. So I managed to get some people to stop and listen, and I was halfway through a story, and I thought, okay, I feel like slitting my wrists a little bit less than I did 10 minutes ago, and then all of a sudden, my whole crowd turned around and left all at the same time. And at first I thought it was something I said, and then I found out later it was because one of the other sort of nature book publishers had just busted out a albino Siberian tiger kitten. So I'm going to read for a little while, tell a few stories, and then we're going to do a question and answer, as this is an institute of higher education. And then I'm going to read a couple of little short things I like to call literary Doritos. And then I'll sign some books, hopefully. I would love to sell those 23 books right there. You're allowed 50 pounds for your suitcase. My suitcase currently weighs, I've been on the tour for a month, my suitcase currently weighs 49.4 pounds. So talk to me. There will be some deals on books afterwards. And this one I'm going to read, it was a request last night from one of my lovely hosts. So I guess all you have to know is I come from the Yukon. Do you know where that is? It's close to Alaska. It's a country. It's Canada. It's right above you. It's kind of large. It's a lot of people. Anyway, my family's Irish and Roma. I have 36 first cousins, 14 uncles, 12 aunts, and then my cousins all have kids now, and my uncles and aunts, they all have like husbands and wives and second wives and mistresses. And there's this very strong family resemblance on my father's side of the family. I look like all my uncles and my male cousins mostly. And there's also a guy who pumps gas at the 4th Avenue Esso in my town that I grew up in, Whitehorse, who's a spitting image of me. None of my uncles or my father will fess up to having anything to do with this guy, but I know he's related to me, and sometimes I know he is. Like, we look identical, and I sometimes see him smoking in his coveralls outside the shop when I go get gas there, and I always see him, and we never have said anything to each other. He's about 10 years younger than me. We've never spoken a word, but every time I see him, I always think, if I ever need a kidney. And my family's all blue collar, dyed in the wool. And so they don't really get what I do for a living at all. And before my grand passed away, whenever I came to town, she'd be like, oh, great, you're in town for 4 days. Fantastic. You need to pick me up at bingo, and then you need to go get my prescription, and then you need to do this, and then you need... It would be really nice if you could clean the gutters. And I'm like, Gran, I'm here for work. And she'd be like, work? That's not a job. It's only a job if you hate it. And that would be funnier if that hadn't been the biggest truth in her life, yeah? And if that truth hadn't bent her back and blown out her knees and curled her arthritic fingertips back into her palms, like, permanently. Anyway, last summer I spent 10 days at home in the Yukon. My family calls everything I do my little art project. Everything. So I was at home, I was doing some research for my little art project. this particular art project involved going through as many family photographs as I could, scanning them for a visual thing I was doing. And my family doesn't actually put photographs into photograph albums. I'm not sure why they do that. My Aunt Roberta had a whole stash, big magic red bag of memorabilia stashed in her basement. My mom had a gigantic mishmash of memories crammed into a cardboard box in the shelf in the guest room closet. My grandma Pat's actually the only one who ever puts photographs into a photograph album. Most of my family leave them in the development envelope in the kitchen junk drawer. That seems to be where they all end up. Anyway, so I found lots of other things too, like crammed in with all those photographs, weird stuff. Baby teeth, clippings of hair. You know, like to me, if it was on your body and then it's then removed from your body, it's medical waste at that point. It's not a keepsake, right? And but there was tons of stuff, weird stuff in there. There was a drunk driving citation I found crammed in for my Uncle Dave, who he's a Catholic priest now, but not back in the 70s. But I couldn't help but notice that that particular drunk driving citation was issued at 9 a.m. in the morning. Which I found impressive, even for a Yukoner, right? And I found a lot of pictures of me as a kid. Way more pictures of me as a kid than I remember anybody taking at the time. It wasn't like now. Not everybody, you didn't have a cell phone with a camera in it. Like, you had to have an actual camera, and we just never did that. But anyway, I found all these pictures of me as a kid. I don't remember who took half of them. There's one of my dad and my Uncle Rob on either end of a broomstick, loaded down with lake trout. And I'm crouching underneath the fish, between the two men. I got my plaid shirt rolled up past my elbows. I'm covered in fish blood and scales, and I'm proudly holding up my own little string of rainbow trout. There's another one in a campground somewhere. It's of me exploding out of the willows. I'm carrying a gigantic log of firewood on my back. Like, it's bigger than I am. And what I found remarkable about that photo is that someone in my family, in their infinite wisdom, I was about 6 years old in that photograph, they thought it was a great idea to give, like, a six-year-old kid about a 14-inch fillet knife. It's about that long. I had it and I remember that knife. I remember that it was longer than my thigh, so that if I kneeled down, the knife would stick into the ground. And there's one of me on the first day of grade one. There's a lineup. I'm standing off to one side. It's all the other little girls on my block, and all the neighbor girls and my little sister are all in starchy new dresses. Their chubby little knees scrubbed and squishing out of the tops of sparkling white knee socks. I, on the other hand, I'm wearing blue corduroy bell bottoms, black rubber boots with the red-brown toes, and my Davy Crockett fringe buckskin leather jacket. Oh, yeah. I'm carrying a briefcase. So I pretty much have not changed at all. And I remember that buckskin jacket. I do. My mother hated it. She said it smelled like campfire and fish blood. And I was like, I know. It's perfect. And I wore it until it was way too small for me. It only came up to here, and the sleeves only came up to there, and I would just cram it on. So my mom would wait till I was out of the house, and she would take it out of my closet, and she would throw it in the garbage. And I would be out somewhere doing something, building a fort, pummeling the neighbor children, something like that. But I had, like, a spidey sense about that jacket, and wherever I was, all of a sudden, I'd be like, I'd go racing home, dig my jacket out of the garbage, and then to spite my mother, I would wear it constantly for about 2 weeks, but I would keep the, like, bacon grease and the coffee grounds all stuck to it just to teach her a lesson. Love that jacket. Here's my grade two class photo. It's a front toothless me, again, in a plaid shirt, with my pearly snaps done right up to my neck, and I'm sporting kind of an Andy Gibbish shag do. I know the youth, you call it the Justin Bieber look. Andy Gibb fucking rocked that look in the 70s. Know your history, people. There's another one of me smiling in full hockey gear, lined up with all my teammates. I was the only girl, only Ivan, in the boys' minor hockey league for 11 years. None of this seems surprising to me at all. I appear to be the very same kid that I remember being, but looking back, what I couldn't believe in retrospect was that anyone in my family could actually have been surprised when I came out of the closet at 18. Seriously, people, the evidence was everywhere. All over, right from the start, all over those photographs. How could anyone have missed it? I decided to investigate. I called up my Aunt Roberta first because it was almost 8 o'clock in the evening and I know she goes to bed early. I asked her if she ever suspected that I had caught the gay when I was very little. If she ever wondered about the 14-inch fillet knives and the hockey and the buckskin leather jackets and the whatnot. I heard the kitchen chair complain about being dragged across the linoleum. And then she sat down. She said, I know this sounds silly, but I always just thought you were just who you were. An amazing little strong personality. See, I always thought you got it from your dad. Then I asked her if my gran had ever said anything to her about, you know, me catching the gay at a very early age. She said, your gran's gone to bed already. I was like, what? It's seven. What time is it? Anyway, she said, I do remember your gran saying to me that you were exactly right. All you kids. It turned out to be exactly who God meant you to be. I mean, you can call her in the morning and ask her yourself if you want to, but I know that's what she's going to say. My grandma Pat was good for an awesome quote, as usual. She said, I never labeled you as anything. You were just boyish, and you just did boyish things. Keep in mind that we just didn't think like that back then, you see. I mean, any knowledge of homosexuality that I might have had would have gone all the way back to Victorian times. All those novels. You probably skirted under my radar because you weren't wearing hoop skirts and those high-button boots. My own mother swore she had no clue about me whatsoever. My mind just never went there. I just let you be what you wanted to be. I'm not very helpful with your little art project, am I? I guess. I'm sorry, honey. My Aunt Kathy just echoed my mother. I just thought you were a fucking little brat because you refused to wear a dress to our wedding no matter what we said. My Aunt Nora thought my sister and I were just polar opposites, that's all. Carrie was the prissy little girl and you just weren't. You were just your own little people. I do remember when you were in your teens, I remember knowing somehow you weren't happy. You just seemed tense inside your own little skin. I knew there was something going on with you, but I didn't know what it was. We didn't have to have a label for everything back then. My Uncle John was recently divorced and thus cooking an omelet for dinner in the background when I got him on the phone. I'm sorry, kid, but I can't identify the exact moment we realized you had gone to the dark side. I do remember we were all just glad you weren't born stupid. Yeah. There's no cure for stupid. There was that one time, though. You were like 6 or 7. You gave me supreme shit for not attending to my fishing rod closely enough because I had been drinking, but I don't think that had anything to do with your sexuality. Did it? My Uncle Rob was pensive, thinking over his response a bit before speaking, which if you knew him, you'd know how out of character that really is. He said, well, you can see why we wouldn't have thought too much about it. I mean, there's a lot of heterosexual butch chicks, you know, especially up north. I mean, a guy's got to be careful. This one time, anyway, On the other hand, he continued, maybe a guy should have twigged duty or aversion to wear an address, but who cares anyway? You know what I've always said about this kind of thing? It's your soap. And it's your dick. And you can wash it as fast as you want. Oh, thank you, I said. Oh, Elder One, for that gem of wisdom that I may now hold and carry throughout my life. I'd like you to think about this. His blood, my veins, right now. So it appears for all those years, in all those photographs of that little tomboy, there was only one member of my family wondering about me. And that was me. Thank you. So I'm going to read a piece out of Gender Failure, and available for sale right after the show. And next month, you probably know, is going to be Trans Day of Remembrance. So I just want to be real clear about what that day is. It's where well-meaning people, queers and trans students, usually all across the continent, get together and they read off a list of trans people who have died in the previous year. It's almost always trans women of color. Let's just be realistic about that. There are some exceptions, but... So I'm going to read you this story. It's called Rosie. I was 19, almost 20, when I first met my friend Rosie. I still had long hair, actually. I was kind of rocking this Dukes of Hazzard, the blonde guy from Dukes of Hazzard inspired, kind of sort of a blonde, feathered mullet. That's how long ago it was, okay? I was living in the West End of Vancouver. Wet behind the ears, I had just arrived from the Yukon in a Volkswagen van, as you do. It was only the second apartment I had ever rented. And the first time I laid my eyes on Rosie, it was raining, and there she was, skinny, wiry, restless-eyed Rosie, right, standing right behind me on the sidewalk that led to our building's front door with both of her arms all burdened down with grocery bags. So I held the front door of our building open for her, just like my gran had taught me to. Chivalry? Lives? She snorted as she clunked past me in her skin-tight Levi's and low-cut blouse and kitten heels. Of course, I did not know the words for kitten heels yet. But I do now, don't I? Except her voice was low, like an 18-wheeler gearing down with its engine brakes grinding on a long, steep hill down from the summit, and her bare chest above her black, lacy bra was covered in 5 o'clock shadow and painted with now bleeding-edged and Sailor Flash faded tattoos. I had never met any other woman quite like Rosie before. Still haven't, really. I tried chatting her up in the laundry room a couple of times after that first day. She ignored me like she had not heard me speak at all. She made me think of these she-wolves back home. My dad's best friend was this guy named Danny Nolan, and he ran a game farm, and he bred endangered animals and re-released them to the wild. It was all a bit dodgy. Later on, he got busted for selling peregrine falcons to... oil sheiks in Iraq. But anyway, he had this big enclosure and all fenced in with chain link fence, and my dad used to take us out there to see them, but the wolves would never come up to the fence. They would just stay along the tree lines, kind of pace back and forth, and you could tell they sort of wanted to come up and take a bone or a bit of moose meat from you, but the wildness still inside them would not let them. Would not allow themselves that kind of trust, that kind of closeness to a possible enemy. just acting like it was friendly. Those wolves, they would go without meat, just so not to be disappointed by a stranger's ill intent again. And Rosie, she made me remember those she-wolves. She sure did. It took me months. Slowly. To get her to smile and then chat with me in the hallway. And then one day, finally, she accepted my third or fourth invitation to come in for a cup of tea. I called her he only once, early on. I didn't know. I was still so small town back then, but anyway, I used the word he for her only once, and it was barely out of my mouth when she caught it in one manicured and muscled fist and threw it back at me. She wasn't mad, just certain. Don't ever call me he, she said, calmly. Ever. I hate it. I am a she. Her. Hers. You got that, kiddo? You see, it seemed simple to me at the time because it is simple. I loved her already. I wanted to make her happy. So just call her what she wanted. I mean, really, how much simpler does it get than that? Call her what made her happy to hear. So somewhere in there, she took to calling me Luigi. I do not remember why. She called me Luigi the bricklayer, even though I was working as a landscaper at the time. Perhaps it was some kind of comment on my stature I never asked. We would garbolicize at night after work. Garbolicize, it was a word that she had invented and taught to me. It meant that I would drive my Volkswagen van up and down the alleys behind rich people's houses, and she would smoke her hand-rolled cigarettes with the sliding door open and look for antiques and other quality stuff that the rich people had discarded. It was the late 80s, and you would not believe what people would throw out with the trash back then. Rosie had a one-bedroom apartment, exact same layout as mine, but she slept on a pull-out couch in the living room with her bird and all her plants and her cat, Miss Puss. So the bedroom could be turned into a carpentry shop, and we stripped those antiques down and refinished them with love and sweat and fancy carpenter's wax. Old school ways she had learned in a previous life in the Navy. Oak and teak and bird's eye maple even one time. We found a bird's eye maple radio cabinet, turn of the century, with a phonograph in it. Everything worked perfectly. We couldn't believe our luck. We took that beauty home, shone it up, and then sold it straight back to an antique store not one single city block away from where we found it in the first place. I mostly bought weed and t-shirts with my profits. But Rosie was saving up for her surgeries and electrolysis, hormones. Nothing was covered back then. And it was all expensive. Rosie was on welfare. She wanted to work, but you try being a hairy transsexual in 1988 and having a full-time job, I dare you. I dare you. She hated the electrolysis the most. She'd come home crying from the pain afterwards. She called it the never-ending story. She called me Luigi. And he... I never asked her why. Didn't need to. Made me happy. So one day, after about a year or so of her and I, friends like that, eating dinners together that we would cook for each other and listening to Nina Simone records on vinyl, except for we didn't call it vinyl, we called records just records back then, and we'd listen to Nina Simone. I'd cry at the lyrics, and she would laugh at me and punch me in the arm because because both of us avoided hugging anyone back then as much as we could. Anyway, my friend Archie came to town for a visit. Archie the fag from Lethbridge, Alberta. He was a chef and a fellow tinker and traveler. He slept on my couch for 5 days or so and put his Camels on filtered cigarettes out in the houseplant Rosie had given me for my birthday. And he left his smelly, crusty socks all around and the seat up, and he was generally starting to piss me off and overstaying his welcome, but I still loved him. And Archie told great stories. But anyway, what happened was, Rosie came down one night with some homemade baked beans for me with the bacon cooked right in because she knew they were one of my favorites. She was hanging around in the doorway. She was all she-wolf in the hallway, too shy to enter with Archie the stranger sprawled out on the couch behind me. She was even whispering. "It's cool," I told her. "He's my friend. Come on in. I'll make you a tea. I missed you these last couple of days. Archie's cool. He's gay himself." Gay has nothing at all to do with being cool. She hissed a little, but she came in. She drank a cup of tea, but she didn't stay for very long. And Archie was cool. Enough, I guess. He called her Rosie. Weird, though. Said her name like it was in quotation marks, kind of. Hard to describe, but I do remember hoping she couldn't hear it in his voice since she didn't know him. Maybe he just said everybody's name like he didn't quite believe them that they were who they said they were. And after Rosie left too soon, Archie lit another smoke in my apartment. And then he grinned mean and big. He said that was the ugliest fucking drag queen I ever saw in my life. And I thought I had seen it all. Seriously, girlfriend, give it up already. I mean, really. Who does she think she's fooling? I remember the feeling of hating someone I loved at that moment. You know that feeling? I had felt it before, of course, but only with my blood family. But I remember hating Archie right then, hating him and his 10% spandex t-shirts and his dockside shoes with no socks and his callous heart. And how could he talk like that about my friend Rosie when he should know better? He was gay from Alberta. For Americans, that's kind of like being gay from Montana. I was the one who said he could be trusted. Yeah, so in that way, he made me a liar, you know, by accident. So that three-story apartment building that we both lived in, it was sold a couple of months later and torn down to build a high-rise, and Rosie ended up living in a welfare hotel and on Cordova Street in Vancouver's now infamous downtown east side, and she was diagnosed with terminal stomach cancer at the end of that summer. And her doctor told her she was going to have to go off of her hormones and take care of her, quote, real medical condition. She told me on the phone she had seen this all coming. She wasn't going to do it. She wasn't going off the hormones. She had been stockpiling them for months, she told me, just in case. She'd worked too hard, she said. She'd come too far. She asked a neighbor to cat sit Miss Puss for her for the weekend, left that neighbor with every can of cat food she could get her hands on, and then disappeared. It was common knowledge at the time that you could get hormones on the black market south of the border, so that's where we all assumed that she had gone, but just in case, you never know. Her friend Rachel and I opened up a missing persons case for her after the hotel guy called us and said we were the only two numbers she had written down and left on the bedside table before she up and bailed out on him. And did we want to come and get her stuff then? Some old tools, mostly, he said. He must have liked her. He didn't have to do that. Most guys like that wouldn't have. So I still have some of Rosie's old tools to this day. They were even in my garage when my house burnt down in 2005, so they have survived, just like I sometimes dream Rosie did too. Although I do the math, stage 4 stomach cancer, 1988, south of the border, no health care. Sometimes I catch a glimpse of the shape of her or see a step looks like the way she walked and someone else on a sidewalk some days and my heart skips, but always stills quickly. I know Rosie is dead. She wasn't for a while when she was first gone, but she is now. I can feel it. I still remember everything I learned from Rosie. She taught me how to take something most people might just throw out and sweat and work and love it back to beautiful. Thank you. So I'm working on this new project. Hopefully I can bring it back in a couple of years. It's called The Tomboy Survival Guide. It's a book. There's a live show project that goes with it too. I have an all-tomboy band. Sally Zori, Iraqi drummer. She's amazing. Pebbles, the 6 foot, her name's Pebbles, that's actually her name. The 6 foot, 3 inch tall Dutch bass player, and Allison Gorman on the trumpet. It's a really fun project. It's going to premiere in February, and so I'm going to read you the rarely heard selection from it tonight. It's called Shouldn't I Feel Pretty? On June 25th, I received the following email. Dear Ivan, I was just wondering if you always knew. When did you become comfortable in your skin? See, I always felt not quite right. I'd put on dresses or high heels and makeup and look in the mirror and I just didn't feel right. Shouldn't I feel pretty? Why didn't I like what I saw? I'm 44 years old and I think I've just realized that maybe girls' and women's clothes weren't right for me. I feel stupid that it took me so long to realize what I am. It breaks my heart that it took me so long. I don't even know where to begin to feel right, good, beautiful. Any tips? I wrote this person back. I told him I needed a couple of days to think about all this. So here is my response to them. Shouldn't I feel pretty? I get these letters now. I get these letters from all over, from people who are hurting. It's a terrifying thing, you know, the pain of a stranger. It's impossible to bear it all. Even on a strong day, even when the sun is shining and my back doesn't hurt and the dishes are all done. Mostly, what I think is that people just want to know they're not alone. They want to know they're not the only one trying to swallow and breathe around the big, empty, abandoned town hall their heart is echoing inside of. Should I tell them the truth, I wonder? Do they really want to know? Sometimes I feel just as lost as they do. And are two lost people any better off when they find each other? So instead, I make a cup of strong black tea with canned milk and one brown sugar, and I sit down to find the trail into the truth of these things in the only way I've ever known how. By collecting up words and then walking around with them in my mouth. Words arguing between my ears, words leaving my heart in lumps and then lining up in single file in my lungs to get said out loud. Let me write about September 1974, when I first started kindergarten, and my mom cut me a deal that I could wear pants to school every other day, which meant a dress every day that wasn't a pants day. And the night before a wear a dress day, I would have bad dreams. I'd have these panicked dreams about boys waiting under the backless wooden stairs. Who's the fucking sadist that invented the backless wooden stair anyway? That led into the portable trailer next to the school where my kindergarten class was held. I'd have these sweating, fear-stained dreams of laughing boys hiding under there and looking up my skirt, and I couldn't even kick them properly, because have you ever tried to do a high kick while wearing a dress? The harder you kick, the faster your one raised leg pulls your other leg out from under you. Hot, humiliating tears on my cheek and my bare thigh all torn up by the gravel. And I'm sure I know many people who have perfected a technique to account for high kicks in a short dress, but I never did. I just dragged myself to school for months, every other day, afraid and exhausted, until my mom finally took pity on me and bought me two more pairs of brown corduroys on sale at the Old Bay in the Quanlin Mall downtown. She sighed and put them into the third drawer of my dresser with a cutting look in my direction, because I had disappointed her again. And so began a lifetime of hating most of my clothes. I spent much of my early years shirtless in the summers. In most old pictures of me, I'm smiling and sunburned from the waist up, my pant legs stuffed into black rubber boots with red-brown toes, good for standing in the shallow water or for spin casting, until that tourist man from Texas, camped two sites down from us, called me young man, and my mom corrected him because I was 7 years old already and we were standing in the lineup for the ladies' showers. Go and put a t-shirt on and leave it on this time. I am not going to tell you again. I used to be mad at her for squeezing me into everything, but I grew out of it. I know now that she was worried about me. I wish that she had named what I saw in her eyes when she looked at me back then. I wish that she had called it fear, because all those years I mistook it for shame. And that mistake has cost us both so much. I like to think that I suffered the same as every teenage girl does in her changing body. I don't think that trans people hold the monopoly or wrote the only book on hating our bodies. And even if we did win at this contest, I wouldn't want the prize anyway. Describe the pain on a scale from 1 to 10. The doctor always asks, but no one knows where 0 sits. Did I hate my tiny tits any more than the beginnings of these hips? It's hard to say, really. Shouldn't I feel pretty? I can count the times on one hand when I did, and even those moments were fleeting, always collapsing as soon as I moved or breathed. My elbows were too sharp, my knees never folded quite right, my shoulders were too wide, my all of me lacking a certain kind of grace. Why didn't I like what I saw? Well, probably because I felt like nobody else did. I kissed my first girl in 1988. She was 32. I was 19. She was a jazz singer. She wasn't queer, she said. She just fell in love with me by accident. I said I didn't mind when her parents came to town and she introduced me as her roommate. I told her I understood, because I did. I was a baby butch who'd never heard the word, and so I didn't know what to call my own self until I first read that word out loud in 1992 in The Persistent Desire. In the back stacks of Little Sister's bookstore, I wore secondhand army boots, 3 sizes too big, and I cut my own hair with clippers. Not a good idea. And I met what I didn't know at the time was my very first femme lover, and I bought my first necktie, and she called me handsome, and that one word made up for 2 decades of knowing I was never really all that pretty. The first trans man I ever met in real life was still a lesbian separatist at the time. He cornered me up against the wall at the Lotus Club in Vancouver and chastised me for wearing a mascara mustache out to the bar on women-only night. I see him now sometimes on Commercial Drive with his full lush beard, but we talk about other things, and I forgive, but I don't forget how lonely I felt that night. In 1995, I started to bind my breasts down, first with saran wrap, fucking old school, man. Then ace bandages, ooh, dark times. Then by wearing one of those double front compression shirts, flattening them and hiding them under my shirt did not make me hate them any less, but it did make it easier to look in the mirror and leave my apartment. In 2008, I was about to turn 40 years old, and my body was becoming something I could not even recognize. Every 28 days, my tits would swell and ache and get bigger. My hips were doing things I had long admired in others, but could not reconcile with my own flesh and frame. I started to seriously lift weights. Somewhere in the sweat and ache and muscle of it all, I carved a new shape for myself that made more sense. You should do more cardio and lift less weight. My mother told me when I was home for a visit, she saw me bulging in my t-shirt at the kitchen table. And don't let yourself get any bigger, she said. And don't get any more tattoos either. So, of course, I took this as a sign, didn't I? I really buckled down on the bicep curls. I got bigger. I got more ink. I felt more like myself. And I wish I could say that I learned to be truly comfortable in this body of mine before I finally had top surgery in 2013, but that would be a lie. I try every day to not let it break my heart that it took me so long. I'm 45 years old, and it breaks my heart that it took me so long. When did I know, you ask me? Since always, I guess. Probably just like you have always known. Somewhere in you, I know. You have always known. I look at pictures of shirtless me at 5 years old now, and I can see the shape of my now flat chest foreshadowed in my tiny frame even back then. I like my body now from about the belly button up. And most days that is almost enough to say I nearly feel comfortable in my own skin, close to right. I love the shape of my ass when I'm naked, but not so much when I'm trying on dark denim skinny jeans in hipster stores that sprung up where Greasy Spoon diners and glove factories used to be. I'm grateful that I can now afford a well-cut shirt and a real silk tie and a tailor, a good haircut once a month, a fancy jacket with these cool elbows on it. So soft. I know these things make me lucky, and I'm grateful. These things make me feel more confident, more myself. But they don't make me. I made me. This world made me. Struggle and fear and sweat and work and words made me. Did any of it come too late? I don't think so. Here I am. I think everything happened when it happened, nearly exactly how it needed to go down, and so now I'm here. And I feel handsome. And I'm really strong. And that is a beautiful thing. So I hope you're lucky like me. I hope you get this letter. and it helps you somehow. Helps you lift your chin and your eyes. I hope you learn to stand up full and soddy yourself. I hope you one day wear yourself on your sleeve, on your French cuffs, on your chest, like a medal of honor. Thank you.